All right, we're finally here, part 3 of 3 of our Fevers and Mirrors discussion. Short and sweet. Make sure you listen to the first two before you listen to this one. We'll be getting to the last couple of songs, including our wrap-up, starting from Sunrise Sunset. So, Sunrise Sunset, I think this is absolutely up there with Halai and Calendar Hung itself, just in terms of its energy, obviously. It is a manic song, and which is, I think, very intentional. Now, this is also very clearly an interpolation of Sunrise Sunset from Fiddler on the Roof. But honestly, I've never actually watched the play. But from what I read, I think the similarities basically end there. Now, I could be absolutely incorrect, and I'd love for people to jump in and tell me how stupid and dumb and wrong I am. But I believe in Fiddler on the Roof, it's a song sung at a daughter's wedding, whereas this are the manic thoughts of somebody who is very quickly approaching some kind of edge, emotional edge.
And see, I had a different interpretation, which maybe
cool. Well, you're wrong.
I mean, obviously, right? Like, I think I'm just sort of the literal straw man in this relationship, and I'm meant to present ideas to just detract from the overall argument that you're trying to make, and then you can strike me down and claim that you've been the intellectual superior the entire time.
Of course.
Right. I mean, we've had this plan from the start. It's in my contract, actually. If we want to, I'll upload that along with my social security number to the Reddit page if you want me to do that. I took this as, there were several moments in the album where there's this discomfort with the mundane and the repetitive. And I think that this is, if there's any emotional or existential crisis, it's that life is repetitive, and that it can, as we've discussed before, like, progress can seem very, very slow and ineffectual when it doesn't feel instantaneous and gratifying in that way. And so it goes back to a scale, a mirror, and all those indifferent clocks. You know, when the page of a calendar is turned, it's no more. So tell me then, what was it for? All of these repetitive days that don't seem to lead anywhere. What is all of it for? And I think that's kind of the crisis that's happening here. As far as, like, how I've interpreted the repetition of the song, both lyrically and sonically. There's this very repeating, grating thing that you're hearing over and over again throughout the song.
I this is a cop-out that we've used 100 times, and we'll use it for 101st, but I can definitely see both. Like, I think the way you describe it, and
we're always so polite to each other.
Like, yeah,
we're
exactly
allowed to have our different interpretations.
I know, but I think what you say, like, the repetitiveness of it and this kind of, like, back and forth between, like, it always is the same, right? But also, you said it yourself, where you have this almost, like, clashing sound in the music. And it also grows, right? It gets more aggressive and aggressive, and he starts to get more aggressive as well. And I do think that you are correct, but I think there could be this added layer of getting into a manic emotional state, of starting to feel a little bit unhinged almost. So, you know, because he does start off in the beginning just very small and very, very wilted. And then ends that first verse screaming, right? Because you've changed. Yeah, you've changed. And so I really do feel that kind of, like, anxiety of of starting to lose control, as if you are in or approaching this manic episode?
Well, one, I think that like your interpretation is spot on, and I don't want to discredit the ideas that you've had, but even if we take away the mental health issue, I think that like the everyday repetition, when examined by somebody who's dissatisfied with it, can also lead in that direction as well. Like, I think your interpretation is accurate and very insightful. But I think most people would feel that way too, especially if their life involves some sort of pattern that they can't get out of, and a life that doesn't seem to change, or not, right, at least in a good way. And so I can definitely see that anxiety building and that frustration kind of coming to a head in a way that's destructive. So I totally see where you're coming from, and I think that you have the accurate view of it. But I also think that there's something very universal about this feeling as well, of if things don't change and you're unhappy with it, then even like the simple repetitive things start to grate, and it starts to boil over until you're just sick of it. But it's something that could make you act perhaps more emotionally or less rationally than you would like, simply because there doesn't appear to be anything that's changing, and you have that inclination to make something change or to do something destructive. And that, like you said, that building, that loudness, going from timid to loud, I think speaks to how a lot of people feel when they don't have a lot of control in their life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I definitely think that there is a universality to it, absolutely, of kind of feeling stuck and trapped in this circle of days. And so obviously the song really is just these short little moments, each line by line, of almost like different short stories, right? Like, like little Hemingway short stories. And so I kind of almost want to rapid fire pull out some of the ones that I thought were most fitting to the overall story. So first, you're hopeful, then you regret, the circle never breaks, which is a thought that we've heard Connor express back on A Line Allows Progress, on Every Day and Every Night, which we kind of spoke about in our little bent paperclip. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go listen to that dang episode, will ya? So the next one, change of heart or address. And I'm thinking back to Mitchell is moving, our opening vignette, the idea of maybe physically moving, but then also moving on, of that change of heart or a change of address. Did you really think she'd stay? And
which I'm only laughing because it's like, it's such a simple line, but there's so much emotion loaded into that. And right, just like that horrible meanness directed inward is super, super effective. And yeah, I guess as an emotional defensive mechanism, I can't help but laugh.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
The full line being, for those who might not know, your lover is an actress. Did you really think she'd stay? Yeah, it's that bad faith voice in your head, that is just consistently trying to make you think of the worst things possible, for, you know, the worst reasons for the bad things that happen. You know, it couldn't just be that you weren't right for each other. No, she was an actress. She was akin to a liar.
She was making a fool of you.
Yeah. Did you really think like someone like you It is a very, like I said, there are these Hemingway short stories where you can say two lines, but our experiences, whether personal or ones that we've seen in movies or with people that we know, have so much more weight besides the, I don't know, 10 to 12 words that the lines actually make up. I've got two more, and I'll let you, if you have any as well. You're either coming or you just left, but you're always on the way. This made me think of Comet Song on Down in the Weeds. Yeah. And this idea of like the brevity of life and the circular nature of it all. I just wanted to shout that out because I was like, oh, wait, now I've got another song to relate this to. And then lastly, hold your sadness like a puppet. Keep putting on the play. And again, marionette, this song puppet, keep putting on the play, a marionette show. Keep dancing, keep singing, keep strumming that guitar for all the starving eyes to see. And the idea echoes throughout the remainder of it. Putting the cassette in the tape deck. I think that's a reference to the album itself. And this, and then later, like, literally referencing Arionette. Where are you, Arionette?
Oh, yeah, completely. And I think you tied perfectly the last two points that I wanted to make. Like, one, there's this puppet imagery happening again. There's this, you know, marionette imagery. And then to me, sorry, I keep going back to, you know, how corpse-like a puppet can be. And once you cut its strings, it's dead, essentially. Mm-hmm. And so that fits perfectly into like those last lines of, this is something that I've been wrestling with, whether the cassette and the tape deck is this album, which would be really funny and interesting, or if a perfect sonnet is somehow about Arionette, in that you've got a song that you don't want to sing.
Right.
That's all she left. And is that then the tape? Is this like the typical 80s, 90s kid of like, oh, I have a mixtape and that's the last thing that I have left of her. And I'm doing the unhealthy thing of playing that mixtape over and over again. And then that question of like, where are you, Arionette? Which is kind of heartbreaking if you read it through that lens, but, you know, equally as destructive.
Yeah, interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way, of literally pining over, like, where are you? Speaking to the subject in perfect sonnet. But yeah, I think, the fact too that he says, and let that fever play. And yeah. whether or not that is self-referential to the title of the album, because when I say that, I'm talking more of like a chicken and the egg scenario, where did Connor write this and then decided to name the album Fevers and Mirrors, or was he write? Did he finish Fevers and Mirrors? Like, okay, this is going to be the name of the album, and then wrote this song. It's like, oh, this would be a neat little thing. Because too, you know, going back to the idea of what a fever is and sweating out the fever, was Connor's way of describing how he is working through his bullshit, basically.
like letting, we all are.
Yeah, right. Letting that fever play is basically, I think, could be just listening back to his attempts to work through that. And real quick, and I can't believe I didn't make this connection when we talk about, like, where is this turnaround that the character has? We talked about, like, the meta narrative potentially of the album. Maybe the album itself is his attempt to turn around. His, dare I say it, attempt to tip the scales?
Oh, it's so good. It's such a good segue.
But I don't know if you were that happened so organically. I have no idea.
No, we have to. Like, I don't care if I have any other points. Like, that's too good of a segue. We need to go. We need to jump into an attempt to tip the scales.
Hey, it's editing Chris from the future. So Jesse's mic is going to sound a little different. For some reason, his computer decided to use his internal laptop microphone rather than his standalone mic for a bit. So bear with us. It lasts about 10 minutes, but it's not going to make that big of a difference.
And a personal favorite track of mine, An Attempt to Tip the Scales. I just, maybe going back to like the previous conversation that we had, this breath of fresh air, this little bit of positivity is, I don't know, maybe that's why I like this song so much, because it just has this hopeful atmosphere and a little more gentleness, maybe, than the other songs have had. I'm curious what your relationship to the song is.
Yeah, I always really liked the song. I always was a little disappointed that it was sort of short.
I
wish that it could have explored a little further, but it's definitely melodically a very, very nice song. Although, you know, the first half is kind of more akin to what we've heard on the album, I'd say, like, you know, in terms of doubt and questioning yourself, your intentions, your motives. But then it flips it on its head in the second half to really kind of mark this transition that our narrator is going through.
Yeah, I agree with that. Just to kind of go back and go point by point with what you said, like, yeah, part of me wishes that the song was maybe a little more fleshed out. Maybe like another stanza or two would have been nice. At the same time, I think that the shortness of it is really nice. I do like the fact that it's just something short and sweet. And I mean that in both of their literal senses. I kind of want to drag this one into Audacity or something and just make an edit where it ends cleanly. And we're going to talk about why I would want to do that in a bit. But I do kind of wish that it would just be its own song and not have to share the space with anything else.
Interesting. Okay.
But I'm thinking more of in the sense that this track shares the fake interview with a fake Conor Oberst. And as much as I like that track, there are sometimes I listen through the album and I don't exactly want or need that in my listen through. And so it would be nice to have the option of just listening to the song as it was. And I wouldn't mind like a short and sweet interstitial to the last song of the album.
Well, Jesse, may I say,
indeed,
the skip button is available to you.
What? Hold on. No. Stop.
Should you finish the song portion of the track?
Okay.
There is kind of like an arrow that points right.
You have to slow down. I'm taking out my iPod shuffle.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Lime green.
So
I'm looking at the wheel. So what button am I looking at now?
There's an arrow. It points to the right and has kind of like a line on the right side of that arrow.
Oh my goodness. This is wild. How have I never pressed this before?
It's a whole new world.
It's a whole new world. Look at this. I'm learning something new every day.
Well, you know, to your point, I actually used to, back when I used iTunes, I believe it only counted a listen of a song if you went halfway. Mm. And this, the song portion is about a quarter of the entire track length. So what I would do is I would listen to the song and then throw it back, listen to it again. And around then, that's when iTunes would, you know, kind of click it as a, or register it as a play.
Gotcha.
And then I would skip over to Song Past the Time. And, you know, for the same reason, the fake interview is great, but you don't necessarily want it every single time. I feel like you keep that in when you are specifically choosing to listen to the album as an experience versus like I don't know, you're in the car and need some music in the background or, you know, something like that.
Yeah, I get that. And I guess also it, I want to touch on what you just said as far as like the kind of experience that you want. And sometimes you want the, I just want to listen to an album. And there are other times where, like, I want the experience of Bright Eyes, which I think we've definitely touched upon in other episodes, if not earlier this session, that there is usually something meatier to these albums. What jumps into my mind is the People's Key, and how it's not often that I want to listen to all of those like very esoteric ramblings, I guess. I can't think of a more flattering word. They are very interesting.
Yeah.
But a lot of introductions, I think that's the perfect word. It's esoteric. That it's very cryptic. It's something that if you're in the mood for unraveling a mystery or being pulled into a certain mindset, I think that's really, really nice. But when you're, like you said, when you're just like driving in the car and you want an album to listen to, or you want a cathartic something to put your energy into, sometimes the non-musical portions can kind of kill your tempo, if that makes any kind of sense.
Yeah, no, for sure. And you do kind of want different things based on what you're doing. But I guess going back to the song itself and kind of like, I guess the meaning of this song and its position in the greater context of the story. So the first verse focuses more on that doubtful side of the album. And I think that it is very well written and a very, I would say, almost hidden way. It's not very in your face, as in something like Halai Halai, right? It's kind of thinly veiled. And it seems like he's kind of trying to deal with the lingering feelings he still has from this relationship, or maybe even many relationships that he's had with people. So Connor is talking to himself, almost like what we hear on Halai Halai, you know, talking the mirror to the stranger that appears. And so when he asks, did you expect it all to stop at the wave of every hand? I think what he's saying is, did you think it was just going to be over and clean cut after the relationship ends? You know, and the answer is no, because those feelings will still linger. It would be nice if after a meaningful relationship, things cut and you're like, okay, well, on, moving on. But in the real life, when you have strong feelings for someone, it doesn't just go away at the wave of your hand.
Honestly, that is typically how I tend to view that reading of it. But now, having our discussions, I'm starting to think that maybe there's, and this isn't me like willing to die on this barricade, but I'm thinking that maybe we could also see it as like a wave of your hand doesn't necessarily need to mean goodbye, because if in our analysis we're viewing this character as someone who views women as saviors, as people made to solve his problem, then maybe the wave is hello, of like, hello. That's usually how most relationships start, right? Like it just,
I'm kind of talk. More of a howdy person, but
yeah, you know, you know what? Honestly, I'm more of a like a hiya or yo.
If you want to shame me for that, I mean, whatever, listen,
like
man.
Howdy's fine. I like to wear like a cowboy hat and doff it and say ma'am instead. You know, that's a nice way to start. You know, yeah. Who says chivalry is dead?
Right.
What was I saying? I was saying that with that reading of women as the savior of a sad broken man, like the wave could be a hello, and the being in the dark and not really caring what happens after, I could read as maybe once there is some sort of physical connection, like if, you know, maybe in the immature idea of like sex will save this, or, you know, if I just get laid, maybe then I'll stop being sad, like along those lines.
Right.
Maybe then there's the realization that like,
that's not how that works. And there needs to be more than just that for me to be healed. Again, like I'm more in the camp of what you're saying, but just I can't help but think with our discussions here that I've had a bit of a horizon broadening, that I can mm-hmm. see a different side to how we can interpret that first stanza.
No, I hear you. Yeah, I think because when I first was trying to, you know, suss out maybe some other meanings, I did kind of go to, well, what is the movement of a hand waving goodbye, and like trying to tie it in that way. And it kind of also does harken back to the first song, which really does seem to be another key because of understanding the album, because how many times I've referenced back to it. But just what the girls say, maybe the sun keeps coming up because it's gotten used to you. And part of me was thinking like, well, maybe there is a connection between what they say and the lines in the song. So I definitely think that there are other ways to try to interpret that. But the next part I want to bring out here is the first chorus. Summer's going to come. It's going to cloud our eyes again. There's no need to focus when there's nothing that's worth seeing. And this is, I think, almost a cautionary tale, right? I think this is Connor talking about what he was doing and maybe not necessarily a healthy thing. So what I think he's saying is that reminiscing on all the good times, on the summers, dancing in the kitchens through the greenest summers, those reminiscing on that and focusing solely on that is clouding your judgment, making you think that maybe things could go back to the way things were, or constantly wishing that you could live in those moments forever. And there's no need to stop this maladaptive daydreaming if there's nothing good happening in front of you. So when you're laying in your bed and there's nothing but sadness in front of you, letting the summers cloud your eyes seems like the best thing, because at least it's an escape. But at the end of the day, it's not helpful for moving forward.
I definitely want to plus what you're saying, but first I want to do a shout out. But malaligned daydreaming, like, it's really crazy that you predicted the next title of the new Bright Eyes single that I'm sure is going to come out soon.
that
actually really does sound like a good Bright Eyes single.
And this isn't something that goes away too, right? Connor talks about this idea on Lime Tree in Casadega. And I think also, there's another song, I think, on his solo stuff that I can't remember that kind of fits into this theme. But the line from Lime Tree is, so pleased in a daydream or with a daydream, now living's no good. So it definitely is this idea that he's wrestling with continually.
And maybe this is just like a little bit of projection, seeing as we're like very reluctantly heading out of summer ourselves at time of recording. But it definitely feels like when you're given the time to like have that moment to breathe and have a bit of, you know, we're looking at this from a young person's perspective and the summer equals freedom. It seems like instead of spending the time to like really unpack and do the work of, as we've been saying, work through your trauma, work through what is ailing you, you kind of just let it wash over you, which, you know, in a lot of cases is not the worst thing in the world, because sometimes you do just need to accept what's happening and observe it as it passes through you. But in most cases, you do want to attempt to analyze that and do some deep introspection. And when this character is presented with the opportunity of summer, it's a haze. And it's something that it's like, oh, great, I can just kind of fog out for a little bit and not worry about it. And then it's this interesting paradox of nothing that's worth seeing. And it's like, dog, did you listen to the last couple of tracks that you just wrote? Like, I think there's plenty that we could be looking at right now.
Right, right.
And so I just want to talk about, I think this is definitely one of those songs that we're going to go stanza by stanza, but it is a shorter song, so I guess that's not surprising. So we trade liquor for blood in an attempt to tip the scales. And if we just pause right there, that is a very on-the-nose reference to substance abuse, or at least mm-hmm. leaning on substance, if we don't want to go that far into calling it substance abuse.
Right.
The fact that you're supplementing something that is real and within you with a chemical is pretty telling as far as, I don't know. I'm curious. What do you think? I have my ideas, but I'm curious, like, tip the scales in regards to what exactly?
I always took that very literally, as in just an attempt to tip the scales in the amount of blood versus alcohol in your veins.
Right, right. Yeah. Because there is that fun literal viewing of it, right? Like, of balancing your... what's a good way of saying it? Like, your internal chemistry with alcohol, mm-hmm. right? But I think it kind of... this isn't the first nor the last time that we're going to talk about... I'm thinking of a specific song that's... I don't know if we will cover, because it is in a weird space, but the Going for Gold, if you recall that song.
Yeah.
And just the fact that, like, the chemicals covered you. You're inviting... the haze of a substance to cover for the fact that you overthink things, or that you have an overactive mind. And I guess the balance is that, like, an unhealthy one, right? Like, on one dish of the scale, you've got these really heavy thoughts and this depression and this desire to see other people as saviors. And then on the other hand, like, you got to balance that out somehow. So you lean on a substance, I suppose. You do drugs, you get drunk, you do something so that you can be free from that for a little while.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that mess of details, it's those substances allow you to not look at those minute details, at the things that cause you duress, if I'm making myself clear.
That does make sense. Kind of figuring out too, like, when he says the attempt to tip the scales, like, what is the correct balance of that? You know, because if you're maybe completely too straight laced, like, you don't let loose at all, or you don't give yourself a chance to, you know, maybe you do need to get a little drunk tonight because something bad happened. You know what I mean?
Right,
like,
right, right.
You know, not creating like a negative association, like, oh, something bad happened, time to hit, knock a couple back.
I had one bad thing happen today at work in a sea of good things. Got to crack open a couple of six packs.
Yeah, right. But, like, you know, finding that proper balance, and, you know, that idea of everything in moderation, including moderation, et cetera, et cetera. But yeah, potentially a very, I don't want to say a throwaway line, but maybe a deceptively, like, very simple line that, you know, could have some additional weight to it. The last lines of the song, winter's gonna end, I'm gonna clean these veins again. So close to dying that I finally can start living. And this is kind of speaking back to, like, finally we're getting this turnaround and we're starting to see it reflected in the words and in the songs. And really kind of maybe the first time we get some of that on there. I think that Curious Girl has a little bit of it, but more from, like, a longing perspective of, like, there is hope there. I just need to get through. I need to survive, etc. And now here we are in this moment, and winter is going to end. And this comes back to If Winter Ends as well, you know, the first song on Letting Off the Happiness, kind of saying that his heart is going to thaw Wait, that's a different song. That's June on the West Coast. And it continues to be. So, but, you know, maybe that speaks to how much Connor likes using seasons for these kinds of mood changes and shifts in his own life. But what I specifically want to say, too, about these lines is it makes me again think of what I was talking about with Calendar Hung Itself, how that might parallel with Let's Not Shit Ourselves. And then also what I mentioned on Curious Girl, when he says, I put my face in the dirt and then finally I see this guy that has been avoiding me. It kind of, I think that this is a mirror line. Not a mirror as in the symbol, but this line mirrors that he got so close to dying that he finally can start living.
There is something a little tragic about this too, because there is a very pesky word in this last stanza of again. And it does make me think, where is this again coming from? Like, how many times has this situation been on repeat? Winter's going to end. I'm going to clean these veins again. And is this the last time? Or are we prepping ourselves for another summer of, you know, the warm summer haze of not worrying about much? And then as soon as the weather gets cold again, we get into this, we get into the dark places, and then we need to start worrying again about substance abuse. As upbeat and one of my favorite songs on the album, I don't want to say it tricks me, because that's a little unfair, but just the fact that it has this hopeful feeling, that word again definitely throws doubt into how hopeful we should be about this song. But I did want to bring parallels between this and Calais to Dover on the newest album. And the line, no brushes with death could keep us sober, which seems to echo this line really, really nicely. As far as like, I'm going to clean these veins again. How many times do we have to go through this process until you realize no brushes with death will keep us sober?
Yeah, I think it's a challenging one, because I think you gotta hope that although he's saying again that maybe this is the final time, right?
Mm, exactly.
So, you know, I think you maybe do have opportunity to read it in either way, and I guess it depends on your mood and the listener if you wanna take it the whichever route. I know I'm often guilty of looking for the most depressing way to read something, because, you know, why not? that's me.
hey, for then, a pessimist, I'm pretty optimistic.
Oh, God, no.
Look forward to our Paramore podcast.
It's right after our Brendan Urie podcast.
Yep.
But then after this is when we move into the fake interview. And, you know, I honestly don't have too much to say on this, because we've talked about it quite a bit throughout the other songs, because it does connect with a lot of the ideas. But what I think overall is happening, I don't necessarily think that anything in here is abjectly false. What I think it is hyperbole and exaggeration. So like,
right.
So for example, you know, when he says, you know, I did have a brother who died in a bathtub, again, you know, potentially up for debate whether this is metaphorical in terms of Patrick My Prince or biographical. But then when he says, actually I had five brothers that died that way, it shows you, it's like, okay, you know, there's something rooted or grounded in reality. And then here is the absurdity. Here is the hyperbole. And I think most of the ideas throughout this interview are grounded in reality. And then his friend, I think Todd Fink, is the person that voices him. He basically gives his most uncharitable impression of Connor, the right. Sad boy. And you know, it's obviously all in good fun and humor. But yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't have too much else to add besides like what we've been talking about throughout this a whole experience. I will say though that
this is a really good case for how challenging satire can be in art, where mm-hmm. like all of this, as you said, was exaggerated to the extent of good fun, but it does make you think, like, even in the moments where I'm sorry, I'm trying to find it now. I had mentioned this previously, but Arionette, like how he says that he doesn't want to talk about her in case she's listening. And when asked, like, well, do you think she's listening? No, I made her up. Like, she's not a real person. Mm-hmm. Like, that's supposed to be mocking, right? It's supposed to be ironic. But at the same time, it's like kind of the most true part of the album in that, yeah. like, it's she's made up, but she's very much real. And so it works in this really interesting space where it's at the same time overly explaining the album, but also making fun of the album. And I think it's really fun to listen to, definitely your first few listens, just listen through it all the way through, because it will definitely explain a lot and I don't know, maybe illuminate certain ideas that maybe you hadn't considered before. But ultimately, I think it does the double duty of not only explaining the album, but kind of poking fun at it at the same time.
Yeah, I think too, the kind of things that we had talked about in terms of the overall meta narrative, like in the album, speaking about the album and speaking about the writing process and that kind of thing, it works very well with that. Because I, like, to be honest, when I was younger and I heard this, I was like, I thought this was real. I went through different stages. Like, I thought this was real, and I thought, like, maybe it was inserted after the fact, which is more of a practice now that we see, like, artists retconning albums after they come right. out and then, like, slipping things in. But, you know, it was one of those things, like, I just believed. And then you were the one that was like, how would he have done that? And I was like, oh, wait, duh, that's so obvious. How would he have done that? And then finding out, like, this wasn't actually Connor, and the stories weren't necessarily real. And it's funny because as a teenager, you know, the part about I used to carry the safety pin around with me and, you know, dig it into my arm. It's like, I was like, oh, wow, he's so tragic. He's so, like, it's a little, you know, it's a little sad. It's a little pathetic. I don't know. That's an awful word to use, but there's judgment in calling someone pathetic, I think.
And
that's, you know, what I'm trying to avoid. But so I think kind of going through those different stages and then coming to this point where it's a very obviously a satire and not everything is true, it does kind of recontextualize the way that you see the album. Again, going back to that meta narrative about it, that it is very explicitly, I say, this album is about Connor's writing process and fame and the discomfort yeah. it brings. And I think this is as much a shining example of that compared to any of the other potentially veiled ways that he says it throughout the album.
Yeah, I think the fact that it's framed this way, I agree with you. It definitely, like, maybe in the most simulated way, illustrates how Connor feels about all this. And I mean, we could do the whole splitting hairs of, like, Connor the person versus Connor the character, but I think in this instance, they might be one and the same. This idea shows up, it's referenced constantly in further songs along of Connor Oberst's discography. I mean, like, the one that immediately jumps to mind is Sugar Street, where there's a line that goes something like, they took a picture for the paper and they made me stand in front. Like, there's mm-hmm. even well into his career, the person Connor Oberst, like, still has some discomfort with fame and with being front and center. And I think that the fact that this is the most extreme of, like, a young person, like, kicking out against the structure of a radio interview is kind of perfect.
It's definitely something creative. And I'm sure if I was better with like, oh, music history and this and that, I could probably point to like, this is maybe not the first time it's been done. But for me, having listened to it, it was definitely novel at that point, and just like a very, very cool way to incorporate some of that without necessarily putting it into lyrics and song and that. But I do have one more point about this that will come in the next song.
So you're going to play something for us now. Is this a new track?
Yeah, but we haven't recorded it yet. It's one we've been meaning to record. It's called Song to Pass the Time.
Oh, that's a nice title.
Mm. So this is a song that I know we've talked about. You really, really enjoy, really connect with. It's not that I disagree or anything like that, but whenever I was originally like listening to Fevers and Mirrors, it wasn't one of those gut-wrenching standout tracks, right? It is very much, I would say, a song more built towards the narrative of the album than it is supposed to be like, oh yeah, this is... I'm going to put it a different way.
Sure.
I feel like this song is best consumed when you're listening through the album than, oh, I want to listen to a song from Fevers and Mirrors. I think it's going to be a song to pass the time. Not that it's a bad song, but because it is our kind of conclusion, I feel like it makes most sense to listen to it when you've listened through the rest of it, if that makes sense.
That totally makes sense. And I completely get that. I suppose the reason why both this song and the previous one resonate so much with me is because, as you said, like in order for the song to be effective, you need that, to put it in more like English majory terms, right? Like the story of the album has tension, and then the release of the tension is like the breath of fresh air. Like, ah, okay, the protagonist of the story is fine. There was a happy ending kind of thing. And so I find maybe I'm wearing my sad boy heart on my sleeve here, but I feel that that tension is something that I kind of carry around a lot. And so I don't necessarily need to have the buildup of the other songs in order to have that release of that positivity at the end. Right? Because it's... I think, personally, that you and I return to this album as often as we do because there's something about it that we relate to, or at least the feelings that we get from listening to it we can connect with. And that's why these last two songs, I think, while on the surface they might come out of left field, they still feel nice. They still feel good.
Right.
And so it's not too hard for me to sort of plug myself in to that narrative and say and have that catharsis through those songs. Like, yeah, you've been through some shit, or, you know, you're feeling a certain way, but it's going to be all right in a like, if I can reduce it down to some simple terms.
It's an interesting way to look at it. Like, you know, we have the context of this album so maybe ingrained in us that it doesn't necessarily feel weird or have to feel weird that you are listening to the turnaround without the context of the dregs that we already went through.
Mm.
You know, and despite the fact, like I said, it is still a very narratively important song, and I have a lot to say about it. It does seem like to be an origin story for Connor as a musician, or at least what is continuing to motivate him, what pushes him through despite the discomfort of putting himself out there. He's almost martyring himself in the sense that, like, you know what, I'm going to keep doing this because I know at the end this is something that will bring some sort of light, or at least a connection with other people. And what I think is funny is in the fake interview, the radio host asks him if empathy is the driving force to make the music he makes. And He says, no, it's more a need for sympathy. And but I think this is a direct contradiction. And again, how the interview is rooted in reality, but really made for humor and hyperbole. He say in this song, he's discussing the fact that he writes as a way to offer the bored, the despondent, the masses living in the banality of day-to-day life, some sort of consolation, which is the word that he uses.
So I had, according to the lyrics that I've collected, the line goes, so the neighborhood's dimming, comma, I smoke on the porch. And the whole time that I've been listening to this album, I have heard, so the neighborhood's damning a smoke on the porch. Like, the people in the neighborhood are looking down on me for smoking publicly, I suppose. Which maybe is a weird mentality, given where right. we live, right? Like, maybe I'm very much projecting. And so it definitely changed the way that I read these lyrics as far as, like, why the people passing in the cars are angry and disappointed. Like, are they traveling through a shitty neighborhood and, like, oh, look at this kid smoking on a porch and just kind of generally being trashy. And that to me was why the speaker of the song was thinking, well, is there some way that I can make it up to these people? So that was just, for whatever reason, that definitely, that's how I always read these lyrics. Right, and so I don't have analysis for how else this stanza is supposed to be read, but that's how I had always interpreted it. So I'm curious what you also bring to the table here.
Well, I think really I had already kind of said what I think for this. I think he's basically absorbing his environment and people watching, and it's very clear that Connor is good at connecting with the humanity in all of us. And so when he's saying it, when he's wishing there's something I could offer them, a consolation, I think he's describing, again, his origin as a musician of why he makes the music that he makes.
And I think that perfectly segues into the next stanza, which is just the maybe the best description of suburban malaise that I've ever read. Mm-hmm. As far as, like, automated sprinklers and adding more cars to your driveway. And then I find that line about somebody, like, desperately reaching out for some sort of human connection in a world that's distant and automated. I think this is maybe one of the reasons why this song kind of feels so strange in comparison to the others, because where were these people in the other tracks? It's almost like this character is, like, slowly waking up to the idea that there are other people that are completely blind to this, but they're suffering in their own unique way. And while it does feel out of left field, as far as the fact that, like, I'm not, besides maybe Curious Girl, depending on how you want to read it, we haven't really encountered these sort of people in this album yet.
Yeah, and I think the way that you describe it is more succinct way of saying what I would have said. Just this suburban malaise, and it is very kind of, like, chilling in a sense, you know. Mm. Everything you touch gets dusted spotless, so you start to believe or they start to believe they've not touched anything at all. And this idea that the insignificance, which is definitely something that Connor himself wrestles with, is there a point to all of this? And ironically too, despite feeling that he is insignificant and an individual human may be insignificant, he has also created such significance for himself because of his fans and how his music has really helped so many people. In this verse as well, I've heard them sing in the shower, making speeches to their sister on the telephone. it reminds me of Curious Girl in terms of overhearing something that you maybe are not meant to hear because you're a neighbor, or even maybe like you're visiting someone and you're downstairs or something like that, and they've taken a shower. Do you like overhear something? I don't know. And the line at the end of that, "This weather has me wanting love more tangible, something I can hold because it's getting cold," in a separate way, also reminds me of Curious Girl, because he says, "Give me November, the warmth of a whisper and the freezing darkness of my room." You know, I think both of them speak to this desire in those cold winter months just for some companionship, which may reflect a little bit or may have a bit of a negative feel to it, because we've discussed wanting to use other people, maybe not use other people, but wishing other people would be the solution to your problem. Like, if you just had someone with you this winter, you would be able to get through it, rather than maybe focusing on like what you can do and being comfortable being alone. But I do think that those two lines mirror each other.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that maybe what the song sounds like and what is being said leaves that ambiguity very open, where based on previous songs that we've heard, it could have some dangerous connotations, but also you can't help but, I don't know, personally, I can't help but get roped up into this character's desire just to be basically like just held and, you know, comforted in some way. And it's kind of easy when you get into the song to sort of forget the other dangerous things that have been said previously. But I don't know, just something about this song coupled with the last song gives me a better outlook of where these lines are coming from. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. Yeah, maybe that might be me being biased towards a happier sounding song. But whether it's temporary or a permanent change, I definitely feel more positive about this interaction than the previous ones involving and women and their place in the healing process.
No, I see what you're saying. And I don't mean to say that as if like, oh, if you want to spend your time with another person, like you selfish bastard. Like, you know, obviously
you debased swine.
Obviously companionship is very important, whether romantic or otherwise, just like having another person that you can feel comfortable and around. And, you know, for many of us, we have those friends. I mean, Connor is not without friends, obviously. People that he makes this music with, he's in a band with Mike, but there is obviously something different for a romantic companionship, which sounds like what he hopes for. Moving on in the song, though, I spent a lot of time thinking about the "hold up a fist to the flame in the sky" line, because I think, again, that is one of those beautiful lines that Connor writes and the imagery he conjures up. And really the best way I think I could describe what he's saying, I thought back to "Attempt to Tip the Scales" and the idea of summer clouding your eyes, perhaps offering a way to stop that daydreaming of the always perfect, this idyllic past, and just saying that it blinds you, right? You block out the sun, because if you let yourself get soaked up too much in this perfect daydream, it's going to blind you to your future and moving on, which is kind of what I was mentioning on the last track.
Yeah, that's a really interesting read, and not as a like a contradiction, but I'm curious what you think of there is that awareness of that implication. Of not, I mean, to boil it down to essentials, like not getting your hopes up over a certain thing because that will leave you blind to other things. I'm curious about, like, in the next stanza, how there is that reference to I assume to Ruba,
from right. Curious Girl, and how I'm not sure whether I could see arguments for this supporting your claim, but I can also see it as far as like, is this one moment where the character realizes that this hope will blind them and then just proceeds on anyway? Or they proceed on knowing that, like, all right, let me not get my hopes up. Let me not put all my eggs in this basket, so to speak.
Well, sorry, I may have misspoke. I'm not saying, I wasn't trying to say that hope is something that will blind you. I was speaking more to the idea of living your life in the past of of like the perfect relationships and those kinds of things.
The what ifs.
Is blinding, right? Instead of moving on, just solely focusing on what you had is blinding to you.
The next stanza has me curious because there are so many seeming contradictions happening in this, because there is almost a surrender to the suburban malaise in this one, but there's also that reference to Ruba and the fact that there is some connection, some savior, and that uncertainty, but it's not framed the way the other songs are, where I don't know, maybe in previous songs it did have that that pathos, that patheticness, but in this one I can't really perceive that here. I think this is just honest, if I'm making myself clear here when I say that.
I think I understand what you're saying, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's kind of going back to a more earnest idea of love, a more, I don't want to see, maybe the word pure, I don't know, pure form of hope and wanting for the future, rather than one that is tinged with kind of like a selfishness, that idea of if I can find someone that loves me, I can pull myself out, versus I want to be better, and because I am better, I feel I am ready for a relationship or to feel that hope for someone, if that was the way you were saying it.
Yeah, no. You actually helped clarify some of my own feelings towards this, because I think what you were mentioning too was like maybe a move away from seeing a relationship with somebody as something utilitarian, like, oh, this person is here to serve a function to like get me better, as opposed to like, I'm going to share with you who I am, and are you still going to want me after that? Is definitely a marked change from like, I don't know, like that very heavily implied, this person will save me, versus my cards are on the table. Are we still going to be together? There's a huge difference in that. And I think, yeah, thank you for pointing that out. That's like an important nuance.
You are so welcome.
Oh man, what would I do without you?
Well, I think, you know, I have two things to say, and I'll go out of order, because I want to respond first to that idea of that secret drawer, right? And it that idea of feeling that you can love and be loved despite your secrets and your past and all that kind of stuff. And this is a callback to Arianette, right? Because that's what he said, the first lines of the song, where the fragile keep secrets buried in pockets. And I think he is very clearly drawing a distinction of himself then and where he is now, and that approach, kind of like what you're speaking to. But earlier on too, I want to mention in the verse, the lyrics, I've locked my actions in the grooves of routine, so I may never be free of this apathy. And I think he is describing maybe a vinyl here, of, you know, maybe describing this era, this relic of his life, the rut that he was in. And I think he's kind of saying that whenever you listen to this, I will forever be the Connor in, let's say, 1999 when he was writing, or 2000 when it came out. I will always be that Connor, because he's locked it in this routine, in this groove. But then, you know, afterwards, he's saying that there is still hope for him. So I think, again, this idea of Fevers and Mirrors literally being about the creation of his music, for me, and I could be interpreting it wrong, but it seems like a smoking gun almost, that he's of the going back to sunrise, sunset, letting the fever play, and then we're here, and literally his actions are locked in the grooves of the vinyl that we listen to. Or yeah,
brings up an interesting question of like, if that like a meta analysis is like, if we're going to run with that, then is this kind of the, like, is this sort of the, not to make it sound ridiculous, but like, hey, here, I'm really into you, but like, listen to this album, and if you like it, then we have a chance of like making this thing. Like, is that the end game here?
Maybe.
In a way, like, what an alpha move. Like, let me write an indie heartthrob album, and like, honestly, you're either gonna make them cry, make them run away, or you found the one, and right. You're just gonna have to find out. But.
You got to roll the dice.
Those dice.
33% chance for love on a first date. I mean, I take those odds.
Yeah, I'd throw those dice. Like,
you actually have to go on a date first to have those odds. But right. you know, maybe one day when I'm older.
Maybe one day when all this is past, and like, we can actually go to a restaurant in public, and I can go back to that our too, place yeah. in like a way that's not.
Whoa, Jesse, coming a little strong there, buddy. All right, it's just the first date, going back to your place.
But I read on this website, sorry, hang on, I'm just bringing it up now. Chris's dating hacks. It says here, like, bring her home the first date and play Fevers and Mirrors, and like,
oh, I've that been must doing be a different, that, and different.
I, listener. It's been working for the whole zero times that I've been successful with it. So
it's,
I don't,
it's never
see the
failed,
problem.
Right?
It's never failed. Yeah.
Oh God. How do we even bring us back into the discussion about the song? But, what I'll say is I'm going to wrap up this song for me. And if you have anything else too, please feel free. But I think, this song, A Song to Pass the Time, both in title and in description, is what Connor is doing to keep himself sane, you know, keep himself moving and going. He is conflicted that it's all on display, but ultimately this is helpful. It helps him reflect. It maybe helps him understand, heal. And it also has the added benefit of connecting, consoling, and being meaningful to people other than himself. So despite that conflict, you know, he is not singing for the reviews, for the money, but I think it would be hard to deny, and maybe this is wrong for me to put these words in Connor's mouth, but I do think that Connor does this for himself, obviously, for the catharsis, but also for us, for the listeners to connect with.
I think that that's very well said. And yeah, I mean, I think I was actually having this discussion with somebody earlier today. And the fact that like nobody makes art with the intention of it not being heard. Or being like absorbed in some way. And so I think it is partially for the artist and I don't mean selfish in like the greedy way, but like it is for the person who makes the art, I should say. It is for you. But at the same time, if it wasn't for other people, then we wouldn't be listening to it, right? Like, we wouldn't, it's as much for him as it is for us. But I also think it's worth showing those uglier sides of your own thoughts, because it benefits you as well as your audience. Like, just, I think it's a very modern mentality to like want to present a perfect version of yourself. Not to get like too political here, but like Twitter is really shitty about this, where you can dig up somebody's very off color tweets from long ago. And, you know, somebody could not have those views now and can very actively not have those views. But if you drag up old tweets out of context, it makes them look like a shitty person. But I think it's important to, you know, we all have the negative sides of us that we want to change and grow through. And if we don't go through them, then what are we growing from? If I'm making myself clear here. If somebody were to take this album out of context and talk about the things that we've picked out, like how the narrator of these stories tends to view women as like tools for being saved, as strictly plot devices for the self-insert's own savior, that could come across as really dangerous. But at the same time, if you don't show that, if you don't show that uglier side, then you can't have this positive ending such as this one, where it ends with laughter. Like, I'm hoping one day when I look back at this album, when I look back at this art, that I'll just laugh at how silly I was. And hopefully everything that all of the things that I've bared in this album will be in service of the fact that in the future, I will be in a better place. And I think that's a really positive way to end the album.
Yeah. And I mean, of course, that's definitely the desire. This album is, as I said before, one of self-reflection. And really, I think, as you mentioned, it's one of change and one of growth as well. And I guess that with that being said, we have been talking overall messages, themes of the album. Would you like to transition over into like our final thoughts, basically?
That sounds good to me. I mean, I don't really have much else to say on the front of final thoughts, because it wraps up for me those thoughts exactly. I think that this album as a whole is sort of an exercise in exercising your demons. And it's a deep, maybe psychoanalysis is like a little cliched at this point, but it's an exploration into personal trauma. And it's a mirror, right? Like, you look into it and you're hyper analyzing your own reflection and writing down what you're finding. And I think the hope at the end of it all is that one day you'll grow to realize how silly you were for doing that in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that's not to discredit the pain that you went through then, because if you didn't go through that pain, you wouldn't be the person you are now. And again, to reaffirm our warning, I'm not saying that there's glory in personal anguish or depression or anything like that, but rather there is something admirable in dealing with that, in working through it in a healthy way. And I think that making art is one of those healthy ways.
Yeah. I'd say overall for me, like, I'm pretty comfortable. I'm pretty confident in my reading of the album. You know, I think there are probably things that people can disagree with and maybe points I could have made stronger. But overall, I think this idea of, I'm going to go back to Spindle, Darkness, Fever, Necklace, because I kind of set it up there and I want to kind of tie the knot. Yeah, exactly. And really the girls bringing water line. What he's saying, again, I think the girls bringing water is death. I think it is that rebirth, rather. And I think that's kind of where we land with it. this putting your face in the dirt and finally see the sky that has been avoiding you. And that is the water that ends up cooling the fever, right? Because this pain, whatever, as you kind of start your life again, back to square one, you kind of want this clean slate. And I think that is the hope for Connor. And, sweating it out is that reference to going through the worst of it through writing this album and writing down your experiences to then come out on the other side. So going back to the title of the album, Fevers and Mirrors, I think is a much better way of saying an album about me reflecting on my trauma, right? Because if the fever is this trauma, this depression, whatever it might be, and the mirror is self-reflection, the album can literally be seen as just that, as Connor reflecting on his depression, on his fevers. I think it's a really cool idea for an album. It's relatively comfortably hidden, and maybe I'm just dumb and it's not, and people are like, oh wow, you didn't get that. But it does end up being well explained in the symbols and when you really start to kind of dig into the album.
Yeah, I mean, I actually never thought about that before, because I think that people like us who listen to these albums religiously, like, we're so focused on the minutia that maybe we missed the big points. Like,
right.
Wait, you didn't get that? Like, I can see definitely an outsider being like, yeah, I could kind of just see that based on title alone, that it's meant to be like anguish and self-reflection.
Exactly.
Like, that seems kind of obvious. But I think that that's a plus to the lyrics and to the songs themselves, that you can get so roped up in the story and of the individual songs that you get into that mindset of like picking apart the very small things. And I think that makes that to me is evidence of an effective album, that it draws you away from the broad strokes, brings you into the minutia, and then at the end pulls you back away and says, see, look at all of this. Look at all this mess that we've made. Hopefully we can laugh about this in later years. I'm being flippant, of course. I don't actually, you know what I mean.
Yeah, for sure. And what I will say, kind of maybe wrapping this freaking bear of an episode up, is that I really do recommend that if you like Bright Eyes or a specific song, album by any band, try this. Try taking a deep dive into it. Like, we've said it. Favorite Bright Eyes album. This is potentially my favorite album ever. There's maybe a little argument to be made, not for right now, not for here. And just the amount of like little things I discovered that doing this brought to light is just why I love this process. You know, I'd say most of what we spoke about during the songs were not ideas that I had before. It was after going through that concerted effort, pulling some of that stuff out. And it was just, it felt really cool being able to do that. And for me as well, like trying to put into words and convey like why Something Vague is my favorite song. You know, why do I think it's so beautiful? Because I think ultimately that is how we best express ourselves, or maybe that's the way I express myself best, is through the music that I really, really like. And before this process, it probably wouldn't have been so coherent. Maybe it wasn't coherent. I don't know. But it definitely would have been much worse had I not set my sights on like how to, or wanting to discuss it.
I mean, I feel like I had a similar-ish experience doing this. Like, I feel like most of my ideas were living in my head for a while. However, in us
talking about it and making the deliberate effort to like really hash it out, I came out with new ideas and not even new ideas. Of course, you gave me new ideas. I would never take that credit away from you. But I also, like, in the process of talking about this on the podcast, was like, oh, here's a different way that I hadn't considered looking at it just through talking through it, you know?
It's like working on your math homework or whatever. It's like, it seems really difficult. And then all you need is to talk it through with someone. And you'll find that a lot of those ideas kind of start to bubble to the top. Shoot, man, said it. Bear of an episode. It was really, really exciting to go through this. I am very excited to release it, but not excited to edit it.
Oh my goodness. We might have to like sprinkle in some goodies throughout the next few weeks of us like of the flubs that we end up cutting, just to like, because yeah. I mean, there are some golden ones that I genuinely want to share with people, but like I think it's gonna be a
folks, if you only knew. And I would say that probably uncut we are at least at 4 hours of recording time. On this.
Yeah, no, at the very least. And I'm gonna say that's even an unrealistic idea. Like, I think it's way more than that, but let's flatter ourselves and say a total it's 4 hours.
Right. Yeah. You know, obviously if you hung in there through all of this, and you found it interesting, thank you so much. I think that's the best thing I could say is like, wow, you actually listened through. We probably should be joining your Patreon, but since you don't have one, perhaps you should consider joining ours. Connorsbasement.com. But I guess those are the final thoughts, man. That's all I got for everyone. Thank you, really, truly.
Yeah, thanks. Honestly, for joining us.
I'm just gonna keep saying things until you cut me off.
Then we're just going to keep going and we'll add another hour to the runtime.
Add another hour.
Oh, you know what would be really funny is if, and here's
the
thing.
We just end it right here in the middle of what you're saying.
Okay, yeah. Actually, that's exactly what I was going to
see what we did there. Look at us. Look at us. We're just a couple of goofy guys doing goofy and silly things. But, well, I don't have too much else to say that hasn't already been said after editing 7.5 hours of audio. So absolutely gassed. Really do want to thank anybody who listened through a part or all of the episodes. It is very much appreciated, and just we're humbled that you would think us so interesting as to listen to us talk for this long. But with that being said, check us out, Instagram and Twitter at Connor's Basement. Consider joining our Patreon. You can find that on connorsbasement.com. Real quick, thanks to our patrons, Goldie, Lad, and Mom. Next up will be Lifted, which is an amazing record, of course, for some people, one of the gold standards when it comes to Bright Eyes Records. So stay tuned for that. Hopefully the runtime will be pared down a bit from this one. But we really enjoyed making it, and we hope you enjoyed listening to it. Catch you on the next one.